Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You guys have heard me talk about Red Door Grill for almost a year now on 610 Sports Radio, and they're the proud sponsor of the Bobcast. And I'll tell you what, I'm a proud eater at Red Door Grill. In fact, my family and I love going to Red Door Grill, not just on Mondays for burgers or Thursdays for fried chicken, but just about every single day of the week. Because every time we walk into a Red Door Grill location, we're walking out of there feeling satisfied, feeling great, and knowing we got some of the best food in Kansas City. $5 burgers on Monday is where the week starts. You're not going to find a better deal than that. The best burger in town for just $5. You want some fries, it'll cost you a buck more. And then on Thursday, we have the jalapeno dipped fried chicken. That fried chicken starts marinating on Monday. It marinates on Tuesday. It marinates on Wednesday. It's got the herbs and spices to get into that chicken. And then boom, they flash fry it on Thursday to give you the best fried chicken that you'll ever have. And then of course, happy hour every weekday, Monday through Friday from 3 to 6. That's where we cash in sometimes on Fridays as well. Enjoy those great drinks. Enjoy the great appetizer specials from 3 to 6 every single weekday at Red Door Grill. And with three locations, there's one close to everybody. 159th and Antioch, 119th and Row and Town Center Plaza in Leawood and Camelot Court. And of course, you can find the location in Brookside as well. It's Red Door Grill. For almost 4 decades, Kansas Cityans have known Michael Mahoney as the guy on TV who is bringing you the news from City Hall. Well, he's much more than just a City Hall reporter. Mike Mahoney is a huge baseball fan, and in fact, it was a tragedy that propelled Mike Mahoney to becoming one of the top reporters in all of Kansas City. In our latest Red Door Grill Bobcast, we talk with Channel 9's Michael Mahoney. I find this to be very interesting. I don't know if you find this to be interesting, but I do. You were born on September 11th, and up until 2001, nobody cared about that day. After September 11th, 2001, to celebrate your birthday on that day, a guy in the news business, is that strange? Is that odd?
I always wondered what it would be like to have a birthday on November 22nd when JFK died, or December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, something like that. I always thought, what's that like? Well, now I know. And, it's not as much as it's cracked up to be.
Right.
Yeah, my wife was going to throw me a party that night down at the Quaff, and it just went away. So, it's very odd. And you get some strange looks when you put that down on your birthday, 9/11.
Was that a big birthday for you that year? Was that like 40 or 50 or something like that, where your wife was trying to celebrate something big for you?
No. My wife is a firm believer that the bank should close on her birthday, April 21st. Birthdays aren't that big a deal to me at all.
Right.
It wouldn't have been a...
It would have been a milestone or anything like that.
So, it's very strange when you write it down and people go, but... Other than that,
you mentioned the Quaff, and that's always like the old Channel 9 days. Like, that's the lore. That was the place where business got done in the day downtown, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The old Channel 9 building was in the Lyric Theater building at 1049 Central, and the Quaff is at 1010 Broadway. And so everybody could still park their cars after work, go over, have a beer, and then head on home. Sometimes there were more than one beers, and lots of deals got cut. I got a buddy of mine I used to play ball with was so impressed with the fact that the general manager of the station at the time, Wayne Godsey, came over, and he was with the news director, and they were bellying up to the bar just like everybody else, and Godsey went, give me a Scotch on the Rocks and Marlboro Red. And the guy, he can handle himself around a bar.
Yeah.
Godsey could, and The Coif is just a saloon. I mean, that, you know, that's all it is, and that's why I like it.
You know, it's still one of those old places downtown. Now that we've seen the revitalization of downtown, the Coif is still like that place that reminds you of back, kind of like what it used to be back in the day before everything got fun downtown, I guess you could say.
Yeah, back when downtown sucked.
Yeah, right yeah.
because the first time I ever went in there was a million years ago. I just started at Channel 9, and where Barney Ellis Plaza is now, the Muebach Hotel was on one side, but the rest of Barney Ellis Plaza was ringed with these dive bars and strip joints and all that sort of stuff. And they also extended onto Broadway, and there was also a surface parking lot there. And I needed change to throw into the parking lot, so I walked in there at about 8:15 in the morning, and here's like 3-4 guys. Boilermaker, shots and a beer, and they had just gotten off work from some of the factories down in the bottoms or something like that, and it was kind of a seedy place, but I went, it's pretty close,
right?
You know, and I like seedy joints. So a friend of mine and I started going over there, and then the Nightside crew started going over there, and then it became a hangout.
So you made the Coif the Channel 9 hangout.
I did not make the Coif the Channel 9 hangout, but I frequent it, and I always claim in there I own a number of the booths and several of the bar stools because I paid for them.
It's interesting that an Irish immigrant would like to have a couple of cocktails after work. And I think that's what people don't know about you, maybe, is that you weren't born here. You came over here to this country and kind of adopted once you got to the United States of America.
I was adopted. Bob, I am part of a generation in Ireland, the Diaspora generation, where the Catholic Church and the Republic of Ireland, the government of Ireland, had a program to basically collect as many illegitimate children as they could, put them into orphanages, and then market them to folks around the world. And what was specifically attractive about Irish babies at that point is that for a lot of parents, it was a high probability they were white.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds very sad now. So anyway, I was adopted in 1954. I came over to this country on December 24th, Christmas Eve. My mom and dad from Iowa took the train out to New York to then Ida Wild Field. Now it's JFK. And I know all this because the old man took home movies of it.
Oh, wow.
And so the plane's landing. And
so you actually have video of you landing in America for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
My folks do anyway.
Yeah.
I already did. And so I've seen those home movies a million times. And it turned out there's a pretty high probability that the mother of one of my wife's best friends was a flight attendant at the time, a stewardess, and she is pretty certain she worked that flight from Dublin to New York and probably handed me over to my father. And there's a possibility that Ian Burns from The Elders, Kathy Quinn's husband from Channel 41, her mom worked on the Irish side of this in Dublin and might have been, and there's pretty good probability, one of the people that put all of these babies onto the plane that went to New York. So there's some real weird cosmic associations going on there.
How old were you when you came over?
I was 15 months old.
Oh, so okay. There's no recollection or anything like that. This is very baby.
I have a vague recollection of being in an orphanage.
Uh-huh.
And there's another woman here in Kansas City who was is a friend of mine now. And we're pretty sure that we were both in that orphanage at the same time in Dublin. And she went back before the place burned down in the 70s and actually got some pictures of it. And the pictures of the rooms inside is sort of what I have in my head's memory. I mean, there's no solid memory of it, but when she showed me the pictures, I went, yeah, that's how I envisioned it.
You're not one of these guys that remembers every day of their life vividly, are you?
I'm barely glad I made it here.
Yeah. So you came over when you were 15 months old, and now you're living here in Kansas City, which is one of the most densely Irish populated cities in America.
Well, I mean, not really, but I mean, we got a fair amount of Irish.
Fair, but I mean, a good Irish heritage here in
Kansas
absolutely. City.
Yeah,
I mean,
question.
So how does that, like, you know, like, do you look at that as irony, I guess, and think that you're, you know, one of the more popular Irish towns in America is where you're now calling home for the last umpteen years, 40
yeah,
years?
Yeah, I've been here since 1980.
Yeah.
So I don't have to
more than umpteen,
okay,
right? Yeah, almost 40 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the very first St. Patrick's Day I worked here because they went, all right, let Mahoney, the Irish guy, do it. And there was a bar where the City Center Square is now called Danny Hogarty's. And Hogarty was a good friend with an old radio personality in Kansas City by the name of Mike Murphy. In fact, it was Murphy's watering hole was Hogarty's bar. And they decided, okay, nothing's happening in Kansas City on St. Patrick's Day. Let's have a parade. And it was kind of a spoof parade just around the bar. Murphy talked it up on the radio, and it sort of caught on. And then the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and especially a guy by the name of Freddie Warsh, took this spoof promo for a radio station and took it seriously. And for about 10 years, ran the parade with a couple of his buddies out of their back pocket, and turned it into what it is today, which is the largest single day event in Kansas City. And we regularly have crowds of 200,000 people along the parade route. And in addition to that, we have a wonderful, well-established Irish Cultural Center here. There are two different chapters in Kansas City of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. The Irish Fest is a very popular and successful event. And there are also lots of little Irish cultural events and parades around March 17th. All of that stemming off the Kansas City St. Patrick's Day Parade, which started in the early 70s, and of which I was the former chairman of the board and Grand Marshal, and still hang around and work with it. I love it.
You love it. It's great. I mean, have you been back to Ireland a lot to see
where you come from?
Not a lot.
My wife doesn't know this, but I think I'm going to pitch her on trying to go next year.
Are you? Yeah. Are you getting close to that age where it's like it's time to go back and see everything before one last time or something?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's one last time. You make it sound like a Bing Crosby.
Right,
movie.
Right.
But yeah, you know. We'd have the opportunity to do it. I don't know. Next year's an election year. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I mean, next year you're going to be 40 years here in Kansas City. I mean, that's a long time to be covering the city, be covering any city. I mean, do any job for a long time is 40 years. What's been the single biggest change that you've seen from when you got here in 1980 to where we are today as a city?
The technology of the industry. Mm-hmm. The biggest change in the city is the renovation of downtown and the probability that Kansas City might become a tech and startup hub. Not sure that we're there yet, but we're trying to make that happen. And then just because of where we are on the map, Kansas City should be a logistical center of this country. And I don't think we've done enough to take advantage of that. Certainly there have been opportunities to do it, but especially in the age that we're living in now, pretty soon, Bob, there are going to be autonomous trucks on the route. And I'm not talking about 10 years from now. I'm talking probably about 2 years from now. And Kansas City is well placed to be a logistics center. We ought to take advantage of it.
What do you think the biggest thing that has held this town back? Because you're right, where we are located, we should be a lot bigger and stuff like that. I always blame the state line. Is that too surface level stuff, or is there something else that's kind of held Kansas City back from growing to becoming what it could be, or having a delayed growth anyway?
I think Kansas City's got an inferiority complex. People here are too nice. For instance, you never hear anybody blow their horn in their car at somebody for screwing up on an intersection. Doesn't happen in Kansas City. Happens all over the rest of America. I'm not saying everybody has to be a jerk, but Kansas Cityans are just too damn nice for their own good some of the time. And I think it's, well, we're not quite good enough. We're just not quite there. And that's not the case. For example, and you know this firsthand, if you go to downtown St. Louis, Missouri right now, and you look around, the place is not in very good shape.
Right.
And that's an understatement. It's downtown St. Louis looks the way downtown Kansas City did in 1990. If you get two blocks away from the Cardinal baseball stadium there's nothing going on. You struggle to find a place to have dinner in the evening. I know, I've done it recently. Kansas City has in particular this weird relationship with St. Louis, where I think we regard them as the big brother, and that they're not entitled to that at all. And I like the city of St. Louis a lot, but Kansas City's got this inferiority complex, I think.
I think you're right about that, and I agree with you for the most part, but I think the Royals helped us change that inferiority complex. When they started to win in 14 and 15, I felt like everybody around Kansas City had a wake-up call and went, oh, shit, yeah, we can do that. We are pretty good. We can go out there
and
be good. I think that kind of brought Kansas City up.
Yeah, no doubt. But go back earlier in the club's history. In the late 70s, they were having these legendary playoff series with the Yankees, mm-hmm. and holding their own. They were winning the Western Division. And at that time, the St. Louis Cardinals were terrible. They were. And I know I'm a Cardinal fan. They just weren't any good. So, I mean, it was there beforehand. And the fact that Kansas City won that World Series, I think, is tremendously important for baseball, because throughout all the subsequent rotten years of terrible baseball, I mean, just double A baseball, mm-hmm. at best, the memory and the spirit that lingered from that 85 World Series, I believe, kept Major League Baseball in this town. And then the restoration of it started in 2012, 2013, 2014. They got to the series, all of that. And now we'll see where it goes, because we're in another interesting time in terms of that team.
Well, it is interesting. As we're taping this, it's the day after they kind of announced that John Sherman was taking over the Royals, buying it from David Glass and whatnot. And I personally think, after talking to enough people over the last couple of days and whatnot about this move, I think it's the perfect move for Kansas City. It's a Kansas City guy. He's interested in doing the downtown stadium. He's obviously going to keep the ball club here because of all of his ties that he has to Kansas City, a former Royal season ticket holder. David Glass made it very important that he found the right guy to take over, to kind of follow that legacy that he picked up from Ewing Kauffman.
When I was reading up on Sherman last night, I drew some of the same conclusions. All right. Guy is a baseball fan. He's got Kansas City ties. I think the franchise, in terms of being the Kansas City Royals, is okay. You can't look too far down the road, but on the short term, if Sherman buys a club, and I think everybody believes that's going to happen, mm-hmm. They'll be here. How he runs it compared to David Glass, don't know yet.
Yeah, you don't know. And that'll still be determined. One of your first biggest assignments in town, I guess you could say, was the Hyatt Skywalk collapse. Take me through how you found out about it and what that scene was like, because that's one of the, obviously, the most tragic event in Kansas City history.
When I came here from Des Moines, I worked the state capitol and was a pretty hard news reporter for the ABC affiliate up there. Got a shot at coming down here, and the job was to be a feature reporter, okay? I can write a feature. They're okay. They're not my favorite sort of story to do. But I went, okay, you get into Kansas City, bigger money, blah, blah, blah. Let's take it from there, see where it goes. So I'm the feature reporter. And in 1981, the Hyatt builds its hotel in the Crown Center area. And one of the things they're doing to promote the opening of the hotel is they want to draw people in so you can see the dramatic Hyatt atrium, which was a hallmark of Hyatt hotels. And so they started having these big band dance parties from late afternoon on a Friday into early Friday evening. And so as the feature reporter, we were going to do this story about this new weekend attraction that was happening. And so we went down there. My partner was Dave Forstate, a very talented photographer who went on to Pittsburgh. And we were shooting a feature story on the dance. And we had finished the principal photography on it, the B-roll, getting people dancing, the band playing, people having drinks, you know, laughing, smacking, having a good time. And we had stashed all of our gear over by one of the concierge desks, which happened to be at the time right under the second floor walkway. We took the gear and moved it up to the second floor. There was an escalator up to a place called the Terrace Grill that got us away from the band noise per se, and we could shoot some interviews up there, and the audio would be better. Mm-hmm. Dave was changing batteries to start doing those interviews. I had reached into his equipment bag to get the battery, and I heard this really sharp pop, pop, very metallic sound, completely out of place with the music and the chatter and the clattering of the glasses and drinks and stuff like this. And I looked up to the direction of where I heard that sound, and it was the center of the second floor walkway, which was beginning to pull apart in the middle and beginning to fall down. I actually saw it fall down. We didn't have it on video. Actually, probably a pretty good thing. But we saw it, and then Dave and I instantly realized what happened. Two things happened. Was Dave put the battery in the camera. I dashed back into the kitchen, went to a hotel house phone, picked it up, and wherever the operator was, clearly she was not in that part of the hotel, because it was, "Good evening, Hyatt Hotel, how may I help you?" I need an outside line. She was oblivious to the fact that this had happened. Called the station and went, get some help down here. I never said that people died in that phone, in that original phone call. I told them that people were really seriously hurt. I was absolutely convinced after these two walkways just thumped to the ground that that you know it had crushed people and they were dead. And then the other thing that was striking about it was after the second walkway pulled the fourth walkway down and there's this giant crash and this dust begins to come out from it, there is complete silence. And it's absolutely quiet for about 5 or maybe 7 seconds. And then people realize the enormity of what happened. And the people that were not injured begin immediately to help the people try to pull the injured out if they can. Some people were literally trying to lift up these concrete walkways. I mean, it was futile, but they tried because they wanted to help. And then the chaos of a mass calamity like that started. I came back, grabbed Dave's recording deck at the time. At the time, the camera was a pretty bulky operation. You know what I'm talking about, Bob. Mm-hmm. And the recording deck looked like a thick briefcase. And so I grabbed the recording deck and strapped that onto my shoulders. And so Dave and I are a tandem. We ride down the escalator into the first floor lobby where the chaos is and begin to record it. And the obvious question, were you ever compelled to help anybody? My job at that point was to be a reporter and cover the story. There were lots of people that were helping. I never felt like they were shorthanded.
Right. Do you think that changed your career?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. I was a feature reporter here. And one of the first thoughts, and it's very callous, but I'll tell it to you because I've told it to other folks. One of my very first thoughts was, you know, number one, holy crap. Mm-hmm. And one of the other first thoughts was, my feature days are over here, Spanky. And they were. From that point forward, I covered the investigation and went on to, you know, more harder news subjects that I was more comfortable with, more happy with. So, yeah, it absolutely changed my career.
What was it like in the aftermath being on the air with all that and then having the ability to go around the country and be on the national programs and the growth of you as a reporter because of that incident right there?
Oh, I don't think the TV appearances had much to do with it at all. It was just, you know, be a reporter, tell the story. Where the growth happened was learning how to track paper, follow some leads, ask hard questions. There were some pretty good reporters in town that were doing that stuff, and I had my hands full trying to keep up with them. Mm-hmm. So as a reporter, I think covering the story, I grew a lot. But, you know, being on Nightline or any of that sort of stuff, it was just happening.
Just happening, yeah. I also read that, like, after that, then you started covering organized crime in Kansas City. Is that true? Like,
yeah.
There was a beat to cover organized crime.
Well, sort of, kind of. What had happened was in the early 1980s, the organized crime and the Kansas City mob were a pretty substantial outfit, and they were highly regarded inside of organized crime circles. As an effective organization, and they had a national reputation. And so anybody's ever seen the movie Casino, mm-hmm. which is deals with the mob skimming money off hotels in Las Vegas, that project, that scheme originated here in Kansas City. Doesn't seem like that in the movie, but it originated here in Kansas City. The skim money came in on flights with bagmen from Las Vegas to Kansas City. Kansas City divvied it up. They were at the center of this. Kansas City was also very close to members of the Teamsters National Union, and Hoffa and Roy Lee Williams and folks like that. The Teamsters local here was very influential nationally in Teamster politics and Teamster pension fund stuff. So the mob here was substantial. And by the time I started covering it, it was just when the prosecutions really started to take place here in Kansas City. And the big federal trials, they indicted guys from Chicago, from Cleveland, from Milwaukee. New York knew about it. There weren't any defendants on that. And the center of the operation was here in Kansas City. The center of the prosecution was here in Kansas City. And so I covered a lot of that and was on the OC beat for a while, especially the guy who was regarded as the leader, Nick Civella, died. His brother nicknamed Cork took over. They had some very powerful characters in organized crime that were part of this that, you know, I got to know on several different levels.
So when I hear you covered organized crime, like you're covering trials and things, you're not like out investigating this kind of stuff and trying to break stories on this,
well,
are
there
you?
There was a little bit of that. Yeah.
Did you ever fear like, oh my God, I got to be careful here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think I ever feared for my life, but I mean, you had to tread a little carefully. You know, some of these guys could be very nice. They were mean gangsters, but some of them were also nice guys if you got on the right side of them. Some of them weren't, and you had to tread a little carefully.
So you never felt like, you know, somebody was going to knock you off or anything like that because you were telling the story and doing your job?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I'm trying to go back and think of the episodes.
Yeah, I just find it compelling on how much organized crime really was here in Kansas City. And I think
it was.
I think people know that, but I don't know if they know to the extent that stuff was going on here.
Up into the mid-1980s, Kansas City was regarded as a city with a substantial organized crime family. And they were called the Outfit. And the skimming prosecutions pretty much broke the back of that. Organized crime is still around, but and it's still around in the country, but not like it was back in the day.
Why Kansas City for that? Because of the location of where it is?
That and the history of the town, going back to the Pendergast era, where Kansas City was a lot more wide open, speakeasies, a lot of topless clubs. They had in the 30s, they had coffee shops around town where the waitresses wore nothing but the but the apron.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kansas City was a wild place in the 30s. The mob had some of that. The political machine had some of that. Kansas City was known, had a reputation all the way into the 70s, really, as being a pretty wide open town.
You know, we kind of touched on it earlier about, you know, this town with the self-esteem issues and whatnot, and you know, kind of baseball changing a little bit of that back in 14 and 15. But why do you think, like, we're getting ready to embark on a new ownership with the Kansas City Royals? He's very open about a downtown stadium, from what I understand. We were very against streetcars, downtown development. Why do you think we fight change so much here?
It goes back to the, you know, this sort of Kansas City nice for a long time, Bob. I think that the people that controlled the power buttons and levers in Kansas City liked it just the way it was because they had their fingers on the buttons, mm-hmm. you know, and they had it the way they liked it. And so why change it? Because they were calling the shots. And those were pretty powerful folks. And that generation has passed and is passing. And there are a lot more. The power structure's a lot more diverse. I mean, you know, this summer we elected a 34-year-old guy mayor of Kansas mm-hmm. City. You know, that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. I mean, even when Manuel Cleaver was first elected mayor, he was well into middle age. He was, you know, much younger guy, but, you know, he wasn't 34.
Right.
You know.
You had the opportunity to do some behind-the-scenes stuff with Quentin Lucas on the yeah. Making of the Mayor project, and we obviously talked about that on the radio show, and I thought it was very good, very compelling.
Thanks.
What did you, as a reporter, as a citizen, take away from that time with Quentin Lucas and realize about him that may make his, you know, what we may see as he's mayor?
He is a very self-assured guy, okay? Sly James is also self-assured.
Yeah.
And I think you got to be to run that. The other thing is that he likes people. Some politicians will, all the politicians will tell you, I love the people, I love the people. Some of them don't. Some of them despise the people and think they get in the way of their execution of their plans. Lucas seems to really like people. What he needs to do is probably step back a little bit and stop gripping and grinning and start going to work. So.
Yeah, and is that something that's easy to do? Do you think for guys like that or not?
No, I think it'll be hard for him to do, but he has to do it, and he has to start doing it right now. I think he's in danger of overexposing himself. I mean, he's still sort of in campaign mode. That's me.
Okay.
He's still in sort of campaign mode, and he needs to back off that and get into governing mode.
What's the biggest challenge facing him right now? Like we saw Sly
crime.
James get
crime.
Crime.
Absolutely.
How is the mayor? Do you stop all that?
Well, it's like turning around an ocean liner. Okay, it's not done quickly, but he is on the board of police commissioners. He's going to have a voice in Missouri government policy if he wants it, even with a Republican governor and Republican legislature. The city of St. Louis is gripped in the same sort of deadly trap as Kansas City. In fact, right now they're in an even worse situation. Mayor over there is thinking about shifting more cops into the homicide department. She's even considering asking the governor to bring the highway patrol in to the city of St. Louis. Eric Greitens did that one time while he was in the governor's office for 11 minutes or whatever it was. And so they're, I mean, they've lost, God, six young kids to shootings just in the last couple of weeks. We've had the problem over here. So the combination of whatever St. Louis can do and what Kansas City can do in a coordinated fashion will be real important about trying to stop Kansas City from being as deadly. I mean, we've already had 100 murders this year, 100 already. We'll see. And I mean, even the Republican governor, Mike Parson, who's an avid hunter, a big 2A Second Amendment guy, is saying, hey, we can't have St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield all in the top 10 list of most violent cities. So, I mean, he's listening to it. The big thing for Kansas City to grow is it cannot have a reputation as Kill City. Cannot.
Right. Will Mayor Lucas be remembered for anything sexy, though? Like Mayor Barnes is remembered for downtown. Sly will obviously be remembered for the airport. Is there going to be anything like that?
He's been in office for two
months. But I'm asking you, it feels like yes, everybody before him got everything kind of done.
He's going to be remembered for the astonishing welcoming ceremony for the Martian flying saucer that lands at the sports complex in 2021.
Okay? I like that. All right? I'm good with that one.
Okay. Because nobody knows that Quentin Lucas has been taking Martian lessons and can is fluent in Martian right now. That's what it's going to be. And Fesco, you can't tell anybody this.
Okay? I won't tell anybody
that. I got this story.
You got the story ready to go, right? You're going to reveal that next year. But like all the big projects are done right now. Like other than the downtown baseball stadium, which I do believe is inevitable now. Other than that, like we've got we've checked all the boxes of things right now.
You don't know. For instance, Maybe he does something to address violent crime. Maybe he's able to expand the startup tech industry here. Maybe he figures out a way how to get the streets fixed and the snow plowed.
Well, that would be good if he could do that.
Right.
That's right. You fix the streets and the snow plow. Holy cow! You got yourself a new legacy.
That's the thing about being mayor. You can say whatever you want during a campaign, but you don't know. You just don't know what's coming.
Yeah.
So, although I got this Martian thing locked.
I think you do. I'm going to hold you to that one. You're a guy covering the news, but also a big sports fan as well. How vital and important do you believe that the Chiefs and the Royals and even Sporting Kansas City are to our town?
I think sports are important as a vehicle for people to literally team build, not in the sports sense, but I mean, it gives people an opportunity to be part of something larger than them. All right. I think Sporting is a great example of that. To some degree, the Chiefs are an example of that. Although, you know, the parking lot of the Chiefs game is, pretty strange place sometimes, as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm not paying $60 to park out there and drink. I'll go to the Quaff.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
There's a real good prep sports scene here in Kansas City too. Lots of folks like going out and seeing high school football, high school basketball, that sort of stuff. I'll tell you something. I bet you didn't know in your fine little homework here. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to officiate high school basketball around here.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I started doing it up in Iowa. A friend of mine who was a reporter that I worked with was an official. He got me started doing it a little bit, and then I came down here and got a lot. And now Bruce went out to Arizona and got to be a big shot in Pac-12 officiating. And I think he even officiated some Olympic scrimmages, I think.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah, he's a great guy. So I did high school basketball around here for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. I couldn't get a really good varsity schedule because I couldn't hit those 6:30 sophomore games because I had live shots.
Right.
But the best rake I got was I was administering a freeze throw, and I wasn't particularly having a good game, not a bad game, but it wasn't great. And some guy from the stand goes, hey, Boney, I liked it better on TV because I can turn you off. and like, I'm getting ready I'm on the baseline, and I'm getting ready to throw my partner the ball so he can administer the free throw. And that guy, hey, Mahoney, blah, 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 blah. And I look up at my partner. My partner looks at him. We just start cracking up. Right. And I'm trying to, hey, all right, let's – all right, play ball here, blah, blah, blah. But it was a good line.
That's pretty good. My father-in-law has been known to go to high school games and haze the officials from every now and then. So it could have been him. What,
I got thrown out of a soccer match for my daughter when she was in like eighth or ninth grade because I was I didn't think I was on the officials because I tried, especially after I did it, I tried to give them a wide latitude. But I got tossed from being a spectator. And my daughter, who is now not a teenager anymore, okay, still gives me the jab on that. And you say, I can't, you know, what are you talking about? I can't believe it. You got run from my soccer match, Dad.
Yeah. How embarrassing.
Well, he really was. He really was.
That had to be embarrassing. In 2029, what are going to be the big topics we're talking about in Kansas City? You may be retired, but some of us still have to work. So what are going to be some of the big topics we're talking about in Kansas City?
Transportation. Education will be a topic forever, everywhere, especially in light of probably in the next decade, America will realize they spent the previous decade eating the seed corn in terms of education, and that they're going to have to restore American education to where it was in order to stay competitive globally. Transportation, simply because what we talked about earlier, this being logistically the center of the country, they should take advantage of that. And then the other thing is going to be the increased concerns over the environment. I mean, we've had a tough year with flooding. We've had a tough year with rain. That's not going to get any better, and it's going to continue to be a something that this region will have to deal with because we sit in the middle of the farm belt, and when the big corporations and multinationals decide that bread is going to be $10 a loaf. Bread is going to be $10 a loaf, and that's going to take that's going to put a terrible pinch on a lot of people. So those are three. I mean, they're big, very big things, you know. And then the third, Martians.
The Martians
will be here, and we'll be opening up, you know, discount stores.
I like it. Where will you be in 10 years?
Huh? Listening to you on the radio. Yeah,
I hope. Thank you, Michael.
Hey, it's been great. Fun. Thanks.
To say Mike Mahoney has seen it all would be kind of an understatement. And as you can understand from our conversation, he clearly has seen it all in Kansas City for the last four decades.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.